I hope I can live up to Mike's introductions. And I want to, before I begin my talk, just comment on the irony. I was thinking about it on the way over. I'm giving a talk with this title in a building owned by the Women's Club. I thought, here's Exhibit A. But anyway, let me get into the talk. On February 21, 1987, the Washington Post reported that the reigning Pope has declared 1988 a Marian year, a special year devoted to Mary. The present Pope, John Paul II, has constantly displayed a special devotion to Mary, calling her the Heavenly Mother of the Church and invoking her intercession in public prayers. The Roman Catholic Church has idolized Mary for centuries, elevating the so-called Mother of God to equality with, if not superiority to, God the Son in the first and most obviously heretical movement to feminize God and theology. It is significant that the stated reason for proclaiming a new Marian year is anti-intellectualism within the Roman Church. According to Monsignor Diamurid Martin of the Pontifical Commission for Justice and Peace, quote, "The Church has become extremely intellectual after the Second Vatican Council, and the Holy Father wants to bring back some of the traditional warmth that has gone out of fashion," unquote. Another Vatican official lamented that, quote, "Today many people, especially the young, think that being a Catholic means to be part of an unending debate over church doctrine or the church's stand on global issues of peace and justice," unquote. The Marian year, the official said, is designed to recover the warmth and simplicity associated with traditional religious life. The study of the feminization of the Roman Church is a study complete in itself. In this essay, I'd like to focus my attention on some developments within the Protestant churches. But it is instructive to note that in both churches, Protestant and Catholic, the feminization of theology and the church is a consequence of anti-intellectualism. The Roman Catholic Council of Trent was apparently the first to use the phrase church triumphant and the phrase church militant to describe the church in heaven and on earth. That was more than four centuries ago. In this modern age, a new phrase must be coined to describe the contemporary church, and I suggest the church effeminate. It is not simply the contemporary obsession with the ordination of women to which I refer. That controversy is simply the latest episode in a process of feminizing the church that has been going on for nearly two centuries. The problem we face and its correction are far more serious than merely beating back the heretical, vociferous, and rebellious demands for women ministers, elders, and deacons. What is needed is a thorough understanding of how far the church has fallen and how much must be recovered before we can once again seriously speak of the church militant. There are two aspects of the church effeminate which I would like to discuss: its leadership and its theology. During the past two centuries, theology has become effeminate and sentimentalized, and leadership in the churches has passed more and more into the hands of women. To a large extent, the two have proceeded simultaneously, but the change in theology both preceded and caused the change in personnel. Though the feminization of theology caused the feminization of the church and is therefore more important, I shall discuss the feminization of church leadership first. I do this for two reasons. First, by displaying the effect before the cause, I hope to draw greater attention to the cause. Second, as a result of the very theological development we are discussing, more people are interested in practical affairs than in theology and philosophy. Therefore, I will speak of the more interesting subject first. During the 19th century, there were three major movements in American Protestant churches that began the process of feminizing their leadership. The first of these was the Sunday School movement. The second was the Foreign Missions movement, and the third was the Deaconess movement. Before the 19th century, Sunday schools did not exist, missionaries were men, and there was no such office as deaconess. During that century, the feminists, many of whom were not women, and most of whom were moderate by today's standards, began their drive to control the churches. The movement first began with the Sunday schools. Clergymen who opposed women in the pulpits welcomed them into the Sunday school. There the women could teach children, and as women, they were believed to be more emotionally suited for doing so than men. Joanna Graham Bethune, a Presbyterian who has been called the mother of Sabbath schools in America, was quite influential in the American Sunday school movement. She founded the Female Union Society for the Promotion of Sabbath Schools in 1816. In 1824, the American Sunday School Union was organized. By the end of the century, there were more than 8,000 Presbyterian Sunday schools with over 1 million students in the United States alone. The Presbyterian Sunday schools were merely a fraction of the total movement. In 1889, Eve Payson Porter reported that it would be perfectly safe to say that in the United States of America, we have 10 million connected with our Sunday schools. We claim in the United States 60 million of population, and this would give us about 15% of the population attending the Sunday schools. The percentage in Great Britain, where Sunday schools had originated in the late 18th century, was even higher. While the Presbyterians were only a small part of the Sunday school movement, they did boast the largest Sunday school in the United States, and reportedly the second largest in the world at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. John Wanamaker was its superintendent. The invention of the Sunday school was a major factor in feminizing the church for several reasons. Not only did the Sunday school permit women to teach in church meetings for the first time, but it reinforced the idea that there were two sorts of church meetings, formal and informal, worship meetings and social meetings. This convenient but unscriptural distinction permitted the clergy to enforce God's prohibition against women speaking in church meetings in formal or worship services, but not in informal, social, or educational gatherings. They seem to have forgotten that God had commanded, "As in all Christian assemblies, let your women keep silent in the assembly." Church, now meaning the worship service, was distinguished from the Sunday school, and the rules that applied in one did not apply to the other. While the Sunday schools were the first major domain of women in the churches, the foreign missions field were second. The Boston Female Society for Missionary Purposes was organized in October 1800. In the first half of the 19th century, there was only one society organized on a denominational basis for missions, the Women's Society of the Free Will Baptist Church. It is not without significance that that church stood for freedom of thought, freedom of the will, free grace, and free communion, for the rejection of Calvinism during the 19th century is a major factor in the feminizing of American theology. Women's missionary societies became common during the mid and late 19th century. At first, such societies were organized only within the local congregations and only for the purpose of raising money to support male missionaries sent out by the churches. But soon the structure of the women's societies changed. They organized themselves into presbyterial, synodical, denominational, and interdenominational groups and began sending women missionaries abroad. In 1860, the first interdenominational women's missionary organization was formed, the Women's Union Missionary Society, by women from six denominations. In 1868 and 1869, the Congregationalists and the Methodists withdrew to form their own organizations. The Presbyterian, its magazine, noted that by the late 1870s, there were 50 more Presbyterian women than men on the mission field. Although such women missionaries were supposed to perform only those functions permitted to women at home, that is, teaching women and children, in actual practice, even this restriction disappeared, and women became full-fledged, though unordained, missionaries. A.J. Gordon, who was an associate of Dwight Moody, writing in 1894 in the Missionary Review of the World, pointed out that, "While it is true that many Christians believe that women are enjoined from publicly preaching the gospel, either at home or abroad, it is certainly true that scores of missionary women are at present doing this very thing. They are telling the good news of salvation to heathen men and women publicly from house to house, to little groups gathered by the wayside, or to larger groups assembled in the zayats. It is not affirmed that a majority of women missionaries are engaged in this kind of work, but that scores are doing it with the approval of the board under which they are serving. If anyone should raise the technical objection that because of its informal and colloquial character, this is not preaching, we are ready to affirm that it comes much nearer the preaching enjoined in the Great Commission than does the reading of a theological disquisition from the pulpit on Sunday morning, or the discussion of some ethical or sociological question before a popular audience on Sunday evening." As early as 1840, the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions had solicited unmarried female teachers for its work, but the great surge in women missionaries did not occur until the 1870s, coinciding with the rapid development of women's missionary societies. D.L. Leonard, associate editor of the Missionary Review of the World, reported that in the 1870s, ordained missionaries numbered 4,300, and unordained unmarried women serving as missionaries totaled 3,400. By the 1880s, most Presbyterian denominations had national women's boards of home and foreign missions. In 1896, the PCUSA General Assembly reported that 1,000 women were employed as missionaries by the boards of the church, and 60,000 were employed as teachers in the Sunday schools. In 1936, Arthur Judson Brown, who served as Secretary of the Board of Foreign Missions of the PCUSA for 34 years, reported that a majority of the foreign missionaries of the church are women. Wives and single women evangelists, teachers, physicians, and nurses have for many years formed approximately two-thirds of the total missionary force. In 1933, William G. Lennox published a study entitled The Health and Turnover of Missionaries, a study of missionaries serving under the boards of six United States denominations until 1929, and he drew the following conclusions. Of the total years which missionaries of these six boards have served, three-fifths belong to women, two-fifths to men. In the course of the century, there has been a remarkable increase in the number of women workers as compared with the increase of men. In 1830, like animals entering the ark, missionaries went to the field in pairs. For each man, there was nearly one woman. In 1880, for each man, there was 1 1/3 women. In 1929, for each man, there were 2.02 women. Expressed in percentages, the missionary personnel was female to the extent of 49% in 1830, 57% in 1880, and 67% in 1929. In 1910, Mrs. Helen B. Montgomery published a book surveying the role of women in foreign missions during the preceding half century. Mrs. Montgomery wrote, "We began in weakness, we stand in power." In 1861, there was a single missionary in the field, Miss Marston, in Burma. In 1909, there were 4,710 unmarried women in the field, 1,948 of them from the United States. In 1861, there was one organized women's society in our country. In 1910, there were 44. Then the supporters numbered a few hundred. Today, they are at least 2 million. Then the amount contributed was 2,000. Last year, $4 million was raised. The development on the field has been as remarkable as that at home. Beginning with a single teacher, there are at the opening of the Jubilee year, that's 1910, 800 teachers, 140 physicians, 380 evangelists, 79 trained nurses, 5,783 Bible women, and native helpers. The women's missionary organizations have built colleges, hospitals, dispensaries, nurses' homes, orphanages, leper asylums, homes for missionaries' children, training schools, and industrial plants. As the activities of the women grew during the 19th century, so did their money. By 1890, the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church noted that women, through their own organizations, contributed $40,000 more than all the Presbyterian churches put together for foreign and home missions. By the 1920s, there were more than 6,000 local women's missionary societies in the Presbyterian Church that controlled more than $3 million per year. Then and only then, when the women's societies had grown to such a size that they threatened the position of the clergy themselves, did any serious opposition to them arise. Robert Speer, Senior Secretary of the Board of Foreign Missions of the PCUSA, a contributor to the series of books called The Fundamentals, and one of J. Gresham Machen's adversaries, asked, "If we have in our churches women's organizations, what have we got? Haven't we got two churches? We have one church made up of men and women with a social program, an educational program, and a religious program. Then we have a separation of women with identical programs except worship. We do not want to divide what is spoken of as the church and the women." The problem is that Speer's reservations were a century late and came only when the women's organizations were threatening the monopoly of the clergy and the ecclesiastical hierarchy. When the aggressiveness of some women had been threatening only the deacons, elders, and ordinary laymen, Speer's liberal spiritual ancestors had been recommending and encouraging women's societies as a means of ensuring the continuance of the ecclesiastical power structure. Speer went on to add, "The great danger is that the women will think that their society is the only thing they have to work over." This was not a significant danger, for by the time that Speer wrote, the more progressive women had already begun making plans for working over the whole church. Politically, however, the Presbyterian women met their match in the 1920s and early 1930s when the Presbyterian General Assembly incorporated the women's societies into the regular boards of the church and appointed some women, a minority, to those boards. But philosophically, the women were far from beaten. The clergy, eager to gain control of such a prolific source of cash, were quite willing to put women on the boards of the church. Thus, another major step toward the complete feminization of the church was taken, again with the help of the liberal clergy. In addition to elevating women to the governing boards of the churches, the foreign missions movement led by women created the first international ecumenical missionary agency, the World Missionary Committee of Christian Women. Like the Sunday school movement, the women's foreign missions movement abandoned the whole counsel of God and substituted a superficial creed that virtually everyone, except a Christian, could agree to. The third major device for the feminization of the church in the 19th century was the deaconess movement. Like higher criticism, the deaconess movement was imported from Germany, where a clergyman named Theodor Fleetner of Kaiserswerth developed the office in 1836. Fleetner toured the United States touting his innovation and inspiring William Passavant of the Evangelical Alliance of the Lutheran Church to begin the deaconess work in America. Passavant's work did not survive the Civil War, but after the war, the work began again. Methodists and Episcopalians were among the first denominations to establish deaconess orders in the U.S. Soon Lutheran and German Reformed churches had orders of deaconesses, and Congregationalists, Baptists, and Presbyterians were planning theirs. Between 1870 and the end of the century, over 140 deaconess homes were opened in the United States. There were nearly 2,000 deaconesses, with the Methodist Church having the majority of them, more than 1,200. This movement attracted the support of some prominent Presbyterian theologians, A.A. Hodge, Charles Augustus Briggs, Alexander T. McGill, and Benjamin Warfield. The General Assembly of 1889 of the Presbyterian Church appointed a committee led by Warfield to present recommendations the following year. As a result of those recommendations, the 1890 General Assembly sent the Presbyterians an overture that recognized what it called the apostolic origins of the order of deaconesses and specified the election, not the ordination, of deaconesses in a manner similar to that appointed for deacons and set apart by prayer. The Presbyteries, not being sufficiently progressive or imaginative to see the apostolic origin of this new order of Protestant nuns, defeated the overture. Not being easily dissuaded, the 1892 General Assembly sent down a similar overture, but omitted the claim to apostolic authority. This overture was accepted by the Presbyteries. About 10 years later, the first Presbyterian deaconess school opened its doors in Baltimore. The Presbyterians, being the most Calvinist of the major denominations, were generally the laggards in the feminist development of the 19th century. They were surpassed by the more progressive Unitarians, Methodist, Baptists, and Holiness groups. From the election of deaconesses, it was but a short but very significant step to the ordination of women as deacons. The United Presbyterian Church of North America installed women deacons in 1906, the Cumberland Presbyterian Church in 1921. In 1923, the Presbyterian Church in the USA jumped on the bandwagon. Now that women could be ordained, it was only a matter of time before they could be ordained elders and ministers. In 1932, the ruling Elders Association of the PCUSA welcomed women into its ranks, despite the dissenting votes of some members. During the 19th century, aggressive women took advantage of the confusion among the clergy and developed their own basis of power within the church. They created, as Robert Speer remarked, a church within a church, and frequently the women's organizations were more effective in raising money. The women ordinarily had no independent source of income than the official organizations of the church. This is not to say that the women accomplished all this themselves. Far from it. They were encouraged and assisted by some members of the clergy, especially the more liberal clergy, who, if they did not accept all the doctrines of the women's movement, needed the help of women in raising money. Clergymen frequently preached on behalf of women's societies. As early as 1815, the Presbyterian General Assembly, which had not mentioned women in the decades since its first assembly in 1789, solicited women's aid for indigent students in theological seminaries. And in 1818 and 1819, the General Assembly specifically approved women's work in organizing Sunday schools. The women responded to their clergyman friends by offering them avid support. The English writer Francis Trollope commented on the relationship between American clergymen and women in the first half of the century. It is from the clergy only that the women of America receive that sort of attention which is so dearly valued by every female heart throughout the world. With the priests of America, the women hold that degree of influential importance which in the countries of Europe has allowed them throughout all orders and ranks of society. And in return for this, they seem to give their hearts and souls into their keeping. I never saw or read of any country where religion had so strong a hold upon the women, or a slighter hold upon the men. The alliance between the women and the liberal clergy is evidenced by a dozen different ways. For example, the Female Missionary Society of the Western District in Utica, New York, began employing home missionaries in 1813 and sent out the recently converted Charles Finney on a nationwide missionary tour in 1824. Finney was ordained a Presbyterian minister in that same year, and his career links the feminization of theology and church leadership. Thomas Murphy, a Presbyterian minister, published a book on pastoral theology in 1877, in which he suggested that women join in prayer meetings, form pastors' associations, pastors' aid associations, to encourage membership and attendance, visit the aged, the sick, and the poor, and organize for benevolent work. Women, he wrote, have the piety, they have the feeling, they have the tact, they more generally have the time to do such work, and hence they can do it more efficiently than men. Clergymen pandered to the ladies in the church by asking for their help. Notice how extensive this clergyman's list is, and I quote, "We look to you, ladies, to raise the standard of character in our own sex. We look to you to guard and fortify those barriers which still exist in society against the encroachment of impudence and licentiousness. We look to you for the continuance of domestic purity, for the revival of domestic religion, for the increase of our charities and the support of what remains of religion in our private habits and public institutions. The view that women are more suited than men for these duties in particular and for Christianity in general is a major feature of the effeminate theology of the 19th century. It was espoused by clergymen and women alike. Mary James, a prominent Presbyterian, believed, what a heritage is given us. Christ is to be King of Kings. His people are the laborers who are to go forth to battle for him. And as two-thirds of the church are women, what a large part of the work belongs to us. Woman is the lever to lift the nations of the earth. William Wilberforce, whose name has been recently invoked by neo-evangelicals eager to find their roots, believed that, quote, women are the medium of our intercourse with the heavenly world, the faithful repositories of the religious principle for the benefit of the present and of the rising generation. There is, Wilberforce maintained, quote, a more favorable disposition to religion in the female sex, unquote. Not to be outdone in asserting the religious superiority of women, the women themselves expressed views like these. By entrusting to women a revelation of himself, God has pointed out whom he intends for his mission, for his missionaries upon the earth, the disseminators of his spirit, the diffusers of his word. Let men enjoy in peace and triumph the intellectual kingdom which is theirs, and which doubtless was intended for them. Let us participate in its privileges without desiring to share its domination. The moral world is ours, ours by position, ours by qualification, ours by the very indication of God himself, who has deigned to put in woman's heart the only feeling which affords the faintest representation of his most inextinguishable love to us, his erring and strayed children. Francis Willard, the president of the WCTU, expressed similar views. The strongest argument in favor of a woman ministry is found in woman herself, in her sympathetic and intuitional nature, in her high moral sense, in her deep and fervent religious spirit. The mother element in woman's character gives her a peculiar power in religion. I think it is impossible, from the very nature of the case, for any man to do it as woman can. In the gifts and graces of a woman's nature, there is that which so qualifies her for this work that the synod or council which forbids her entrance upon it is acting in opposition to the higher power that ordains through gifts of mind and character and through deep spiritual aspirations certain women to this divine work. Now I notice in my missionary exchanges and in late missionary literature that the need of female evangelists for the foreign field is being recognized in conservative circles. Not Quakers and Methodists, but Calvinists are saying, the women of heathen lands must be reached by the ministry of their Christian sisters. And Dr. Thoburn, in an article written for The Advocate, goes so far as to say that the ordinances will have to be administered by women to the inmates of the zenanas, for one generation at least. I believe the preaching of the gospel by women missionaries will dispel the prejudice against women's preaching in the home church, much as the services of the medical missionaries have altered the home sentiment about lady physicians. The peculiar superiority of women for religion is summed up in this 19th century verse, a woman Satan chose at first to bring on man the fall. A woman God has chose at last for to restore us all. As by a woman death must come, so life must come the same. And they that eat the fruit she gives may bless God's holy name. Until the 19th century, the clear scriptural prohibitions on women speaking in any capacity in church meetings was enforced by Orthodox and even by some unorthodox churches. Early in the century, the Princeton theological professor Albert Barnes, who was tried for heresy for his belief in unlimited atonement and acquitted, expressed his opinion that Paul's injunction that women be silent in church was, quote, a positive, explicit, and universal rule. There is no ambiguity in the expressions, and there can be no difference of opinion in regard to their meaning, unquote. In 1872, a writer in the Presbyterian remarked, quote, our confession of faith and form of government, which say nothing on the subject of women speaking in church meetings, simply because it never entered into the head of any man in the Westminster Assembly that such a thing would ever be attempted in our denomination, unquote. In the South, Robert L. Dabney thundered that public preaching by women was, quote, a frontal attack on God's truth and divine kingdom and should be vigorously opposed with all the force that the church could muster, unquote. In 1891, Dabney condemned the women's movement as part and parcel of French Jacobinism, the travesty of true republicanism, which caused the reign of terror in France and which disorganizes every society which it invades. But the views of some Presbyterian clergymen were ambiguous and wavering, and they grew still more shaky as the century wore on. As early as 1827, Charles Finney's support of women praying in public caused a controversy in the Presbyterian Church, but the controversy was not resolved. Those ministers opposed to Finney could not muster the votes needed to condemn Finney's encouragement of women praying. This, of course, isn't surprising if you're familiar with the way Finney was ordained. They asked him questions, he replied, I don't know, or I haven't studied that, and they ordained him anyway. In 1832, the Presbyterian General Assembly, by a vote of 126 to 122, circulated a letter to the churches that expressed the Assembly's views on women praying in public. It contained a fatal exception to the scriptural rule of silence. Women were allowed to speak, teach, pray, and do all the things prohibited to them in meetings where men were present, if there were no men present. The letter said, quote, meetings of pious women by themselves, for conversation and prayer, whenever they can conveniently be held, we entirely approve. But to teach and exhort, or to lead in prayer, in public and promiscuous assemblies, is clearly forbidden to women in the holy oracles, unquote. This exception, approved by the highest governing body of the Presbyterian Church, and similar statements made by other churches at the time, allowed women to establish their own missionary, educational, and diaconal societies within the church, and to dominate both the Sunday school movement in the early part of the century and the foreign missions movement later in the century. Women, the early feminist argues, were permitted to teach other women and children as well. They were prohibited only from teaching adult men. Two-thirds of the church thus became students of aggressive women leaders. It was only a matter of time before the remaining third, adult men, would also become disciples of women. The women's meetings were also frequently attended, not by a layman, but by the pastor. If women could speak and teach and pray in the presence of the pastor, then why not other and presumably lesser men? Were ministers already so effeminate that they could not count as men when attending women's meetings? Feminist logic and leaven were at work in the 19th century church. As is usually the case, it was the younger clergymen who sought to overturn the mandate of the scripture on the matter. Writing in the Presbyterian in 1872, an anonymous author reported that our younger Presbyterian ministers advocate with all their might females praying in mixed assemblies and do not hesitate to declare publicly and loudly that there is not a word within the lids of the Bible against it. They seem to think that there can be no revivals of religion without it. They are not satisfied with female prayer meetings. In 1874, by a vote of 211 to 84, notice how lopsided it is this time, the Presbyterian General Assembly passed another resolution on the subject of women speaking in public. This resolution expressed skepticism on the whole issue. The Assembly expresses no opinion as to the scriptural view of women's right to speak or pray in the social prayer meetings, but commits the whole subject to the discretion of the pastors and elders of the church. What had been so clear only 40 years earlier was now lost in a cloud of feminist fog. A generation of new clergymen had come of age. Some of these Presbyterian clergymen were more vociferous than others in attacking scripture. Israel C., the minister at the Wycliffe Presbyterian Church in Newark, New Jersey, invited two women attending the National Convention of the WCTU to speak at his church in 1876. During his subsequent trial for this violation of divine law, C. interpreted the commands of Paul in ways that we have become accustomed to in the 20th century. First, he argued, Paul's commands to the Corinthians do not necessarily apply to Newarkians. Second, Paul was silencing babbling or gossiping women, not educated, intelligent, up-to-date, modern 19th century women. Third, Joel's prophecy, your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, means that women are commanded to preach. This twisting of scripture was beyond the endurance of the reporter for the New York Times covering C's trial. He challenged Si to interpret another passage. Your young men shall see visions and your old men shall dream dreams. By ordering the young men of his congregation to see visions and providing comfortable pews and headrests for the old men. In the late 19th century, the laws of logic were more familiar to newspaper reporters than to many clergymen. If there's no such disparity now, it's not because clergymen have improved their knowledge of logic. The Reverend Mr. C., however, made one sound argument, and it is the argument that was the undoing of the more conservative clergy. He argued that since women were already permitted to speak at small social religious gatherings, they could not be prevented from speaking at larger meetings, simply because the Bible makes no distinction between large and small meetings. By this argument, C. laid bare the flaw in the thinking of the more conservative, but not quite biblical, clergy. One of the more conservative clergymen published an essay in the Presbyterian Review in 1889 entitled Women's Position and Work in the Church. Samuel Nichols is an example of the confusion of the clergy about the whole issue. For while condemning women teachers and preachers, he advocates women deacons. And then he goes on and he gives a lengthy quote. I won't read the whole thing. But he does make one argument that I will repeat. The argument is simply that, in his words, the public teaching in the pulpit have departed from the rule of sound doctrine in their teachings. But we do not see any scriptural reason why women should not be placed in the diaconate and thus have official position on the staff of the church. Thousands of noble women, as missionaries, Bible readers, and visitors, are virtually exercising that office without the title. Let no man forbid them. In the same year, 1889, George Hayes, moderator of the General Assembly of 1884, former president of Washington and Jefferson College and distinguished Presbyterian pastor and theologian, wrote a book entitled May Women Speak. In the book, he asserted that there were no restrictions on the role of women in the church. His booklet was published under the auspices of the WCTU and received wide distribution among church women. The president of the WCTU, Frances Willard, had published Women in the Pulpit a year earlier. She had been asked to write an article on women in preaching by the editors of the Homiletic Monthly, but the article grew into a book in which Mrs. Willard wrote, "It is estimated that there are in the United States 500 women who have already, that is by 1888, entered the pulpit as evangelists, and at least a score, exclusive of 350 Quaker preachers, who are pastors, of whom several have been regularly ordained. The denominations that have ordained women are the Methodist, Baptist, Free Baptist, Congregational, Universalist, and Unitarian." By the time Benjamin Warfield published his article entitled Paul on Women Speaking in Church in the Presbyterian in 1919, the damage had already been done. Warfield's position was that held by the church for almost 19 centuries, but it had been undermined by the feminization of theology. In fact, Warfield himself had obscured the truth by publicly endorsing the deaconess movement 30 years earlier. But in 1919, his views were quite clear and thoroughly orthodox. He wrote, speaking of 1 Corinthians 14, "The intermediate verses only make it plain that precisely what the apostle is doing is forbidding women to speak at all in the church. His injunction of silence he pushes so far that he forbids them even to ask questions, and adds with special reference to that to the general matter, the crisp declaration that it is indecent, for that is the meaning of the word, for a woman to speak in church. It would be impossible for the apostle to speak more directly or more emphatically than he has done here. He requires women to be silent at church meetings, for that is what in the churches means. There were no church buildings then. And he has not left us in doubt as to the nature of these church meetings. He had just described them in verses 26 and forward. They were of the general character of our prayer meetings. Note the words, let him be silent in the church in verse 30, and compare them with let them be silent in the churches in verse 34. The prohibition of women speaking covers thus all public church meetings. It is the publicity, not the formality of it, which is the point. And he tells us repeatedly that this is the universal law of the church. He does more than that. He tells us that it is the commandment of the Lord and emphasizes the word Lord in verse 37. The passage in 1 Timothy 2:11 is just as strong. And then Warfield concludes, in the face of these two absolutely plain and emphatic passages, what is said in 1 Corinthians 11 cannot be appealed to in mitigation or modification. What then must be noted in conclusion is, one, that the prohibition of speaking in the church to women is precise, absolute, and all-inclusive. They are to keep silent in the churches, and that means in all the public meetings for worship. They are not even to ask questions. As clear and as orthodox as Warfield's statement was, and one hears nothing like it from any seminary today, it was too little too late. What was needed by 1919 was a complete reconstruction of philosophy and theology on a biblical foundation, for theology, not just church leadership, had been feminized. At the beginning of the 19th century, Calvinism was still the theology of America. Its zenith had occurred 50 years earlier when Jonathan Edwards preached and published in New England. But Christians at the beginning of the century still subscribed to a rather thorough summary of Christian theology. By the end of the 19th century, all that had changed. The simplification of doctrine achieved by the Sunday school movement, the perversion of Christianity and the emotional peddling of quasi-Christian ideas by the revivalists, the onslaught of Darwinism, and the philosophical and theological attack on reason had transformed American religion. Calvinism had been defeated by an anti-intellectual movement, and a superficial, sentimental creed had become the new American religion. The senior Henry James, himself a fugitive from Calvinism, observed in mid-century that, quote, "religion in the old virile sense has disappeared and been replaced by a feeble Unitarian sentimentality." What makes Christianity virile is its emphasis on the intellect, on logic, and on systematic thinking. Almost alone among the religions of the world, Christianity is the religion of the mind, not of the feelings or of the imagination or of the will. Pagan religions emphasize those things, but in Christianity, revelation consists of the impartation of knowledge, and the believer is justified and sanctified through knowledge. There are literally hundreds of verses in the Bible that emphasize knowledge, truth, the mind, and understanding, including the first and greatest commandment: "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength." Peter tells us that God's divine power has given us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us. John says that we know that the Son of God has come and has given us an understanding, that we may know him who is true, and we are in him who is true, in his Son Jesus Christ. This is the true God and eternal life. Paul commands us, "Brethren, do not be children in understanding, however in malice be babes, but in understanding be mature." Christ prayed, "Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth." David wrote the longest psalm extolling God's knowledge: "Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. I have more understanding than all my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients, because I keep your precepts. The entrance of your words gives light. It gives understanding to the simple. The entirety of your word is truth." Moses refers to God as a God of truth. The entire book of Proverbs praises knowledge, understanding, and wisdom, and commands all, especially the young, to get knowledge, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase learning. A man of understanding will attain wise counsel. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. And finally, the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is the best summary yet written of what the Bible teaches, declares that God is truth itself, and grounds the authority of the Bible on its truth. It is this emphasis on knowledge, logic, truth, and understanding that makes Christianity a masculine religion. Because the first Americans were Calvinists, American theology was a masculine religion. The historian Moses Coit Tyler wrote of Calvinist New England, "In its inception, New England was not an agricultural community, nor a manufacturing community, nor a trading community. It was a thinking community, an arena and mart for ideas, its characteristic organ being not the hand, nor the heart, nor the pocket, but the brain. Probably no other community of pioneers ever so honored study. Theirs was a social structure with its cornerstone resting on a book." The feminization of theology in the 19th century was fundamentally an attack on Christian intellectualism and a defense of the role of feelings in religion. In 1726, Cotton Mather had written his Directions for a Candidate for the Ministry, in which he argued that learning of a general kind was the second most important qualification for a minister after piety. He recommended that a well-trained minister should know Latin, Greek, Hebrew, rhetoric, logic, natural philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, and divinity. By the 19th century, ladies thought otherwise. Catherine Beecher, daughter of Lyman Beecher and sister of Henry Ward Beecher and Harriet Beecher Stowe, believe that women ought to control education, and women are inevitably opposed to Calvinist theological theories as seemingly opposing the moral sense and the common sense of mankind. Anne Douglas, a feminist who astutely analyzed the alliance between the liberal clergy and middle-class women in 19th century America, points out that Catherine's brother, Henry Ward Beecher, like all his siblings, made his dead mother the rationale and center for a feminized theology. He told his hearers that a mother's love is a revelation of the love of God. In 1853, Bella Bates Edwards of Andover Seminary remarked that people considered an intellectual clergyman deficient in piety and an eminently pious ministry deficient in intellect. This anti-intellectualism was characteristic not only of the liberals, but of the so-called conservatives as well. Many professing Christians today regard the various religious awakenings and revivals in American history as recoveries of true religion. But a more accurate assessment is found in a biography of Mary Baker Eddy. The important thing about the revivalist movement sweeping the rural United States was that it shifted the ground from hard-headed logic to undisciplined emotion, from doctrine to piety, from an uneducated ministry, from an educated ministry to lay preachers and itinerant evangelists who felt themselves moved by the Spirit, but who might be all but illiterate. There was a general feeling that in getting away from the intellectual foundations of the past, the revivalists were getting back to the conditions of primitive Christianity and recapturing a religious enthusiasm. The liberal, effeminate theologians, heretical as they were not original thinkers. They took their ideas from the secular philosophers that preceded and surrounded them. Before piety could be opposed to knowledge and intellect, it had to be separated from them. This separation was achieved by the philosophers, some of whom were romantics, others materialists, and still others positivists. Auguste Comte, who developed what he called a new Christianity, made a sharp distinction between the theological mode of thought, which is to be rejected, and religious feeling, without which society cannot be unified. One finds the same separation between theology and feeling in Ludwig Feuerbach, one of the most raucous materialists of the early 19th century. John Tyndall, a British physicist and natural philosopher and probably the most lucid proponent of materialism in 19th century England, explicitly declared that the facts of religious feeling are to me as certain as the facts of physics. Religion, according to Tyndall, is a force, mischievous if permitted to intrude on the region of knowledge, but being capable of being guided to noble issues in the region of emotion, which is its proper and elevated sphere. Thomas Henry Huxley, certainly no Christian, attacked theological dogmas because he wished to enable man to start cherishing the noble and most human of man's emotions by worship at the altar of the unknown. At the beginning of the 20th century, the American psychologist William James maintained that when we survey the whole field of religion, we find a great variety in the thoughts that have prevailed there. But the feelings on the one hand and the conduct on the other are almost always the same, for Stoic, Christian, and Buddhist saints are practically indistinguishable in their lives. The theories which religion generates, being thus variable, are secondary. And if you wish to grasp her essence, you must look to the feelings and the conduct as being the more constant elements. I hope you notice that James refers to religion with a feminine adjective. He continues the passage using feminine pronouns and adjectives. William James was the son of Henry James, Sr., a dropout from Princeton Seminary. The father and son aptly illustrate the feminization of theology in the 19th century. But to return to the beginning of our story, at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century, the philosophical and theological foundations for the feminization of theology were laid by a German philosopher and a German theologian, Immanuel Kant and Friedrich Schleiermacher. Kant argued that God is not an object of knowledge. According to Kant, we can know only the objects of sensation as formed by the categories of the mind. We can never know anything as it is in itself, and we can certainly never know God, for he is not an object of sensation. In Kant, the disjunction between theory and practice, between what he called the theoretical reason and the practical reason, became a chasm. The existence of God cannot be proved, but we ought to act as if God existed. His existence has practical value, but no speculative importance. The immortality of the soul cannot be proved, but we ought to act as if we were immortal. Rather than morality being based on theology, as it is in Christianity, Kant insisted that theology is based on morality. Practice comes first, and theology tags along behind, never quite reaching the level of knowledge. After Kant, the intellect belonged to science, not religion. No longer were science and religion talking about the same universe. After Kant, if one wished to know, he must turn to science. Christianity could not furnish knowledge of God, for God was unknowable. The role Kant left to religion was that of a proper crutch for ethics. The religious man became the ethical man, not the knowledgeable man. Those who say that Christianity is not a creed or a doctrine, but a way of life, though they are almost certainly ignorant of the fact, and probably proud of their ignorance, are disciples of the false Immanuel, Kant, not Christ. But Kant, while digging the canyon between knowledge and religion, including Christianity, did not finish the job. Friedrich Schleiermacher was a faithful disciple of Kant in one very significant sense. He, too, denied that religion was a matter of knowledge. Unlike Kant, however, he based religion entirely upon feeling, the feeling of absolute dependence. Schleiermacher emerged from German Romanticism in 1799 to publish his famous On Religion, Speeches to Its Cultured Despisers. In speaking to the cultured despisers of religion, Schleiermacher said, "Religion is for you at one time a way of thinking, a faith, a peculiar way of contemplating the world, and of combining what meets us in the world. At another is a way of acting, a peculiar desire and love, the special kind of conduct and character." By this statement, Schleiermacher was rejecting both the orthodox conception of Christianity as a system of truths and the Kantian conception of religion as an aid to morality. Schleiermacher denied that religion was either thinking or acting. It was feeling. And this is a quote from Schleiermacher. "Feelings are exclusively the elements of religion, and none are excluded. Ideas and principles are all foreign to religion. If ideas and principles are to be anything, they must belong to knowledge, which is a different department of life than religion." Unquote. If religion consists in feeling, then Schleiermacher was quite correct when he instructed his readers to contemplate their own navels. "But I must direct you to your own selves," he wrote. "You must apprehend a living movement. You must know how to listen to yourselves before your own consciousness. Thus, as a feeling person, you can become an object to yourself, and you can contemplate your own feeling." Both sentimentality and subjectivism spring from Schleiermacher. They are the twin heresies of modern religion masquerading as Christianity. They pervade Protestant and Catholic, conservative and liberal, liturgical and charismatic churches. Schleiermacher believed that, quote, "to seek and to find this infinite and eternal factor in all that lives and moves, in all growth and change, in all action and passion, and to have and to know life itself only in immediate feeling, that is religion. If religion is feeling, it follows that Christian doctrines are accounts of the Christian religious affections set forth in speech. Doctrines, which Schleiermacher called symbols, may vary from religion to religion, and even from person to person. Thousands might be moved religiously in the same way, and yet each led, not so much by disposition as by external circumstances, might designate his feelings by different symbols. To those who are preoccupied with doctrines, the people Schleiermacher scornfully called systematizers, Schleiermacher writes, "Nothing is of less importance to religion, for it knows nothing of deducing and connecting." Schleiermacher did not believe that religion could be charged with any wrong. What could be accused of wrongdoing was not religion, but its corruption by dogma. Blame those who corrupt religion, who flood it with an army of formulas and definitions, and seek to cast it into fetters of a so-called system. What is it in religion about which men have quarreled and made parties and kindled wars? About definitions, the practical sometimes, the theoretical always, both of which belong elsewhere. But religion does not, even once, desire to bring those who believe and feel to one's belief and one's feeling. Each seer is a new priest, a new mediator, a new organ. Those who say that creeds and confessions divide and destroy the unity of the church are, unwittingly, disciples of Schleiermacher. The ignorant men who call themselves practical are always the unwitting slaves of some defunct theologian or philosopher. Schleiermacher wrote, "I ask, therefore, that you turn from everything usually reckoned religion and fix your regard on the inward emotions and dispositions." Significantly, Schleier pointed out that these feelings, this piety, religion itself, dwells peculiarly in women. The feeling may dwell in many sound and strong, as, for example, in almost all women, without ever having been specially a matter of contemplation. What follows from all this, and what Schleiermacher was eager to point out, it is that if religion is different from its expressions, then those expressions can be changed and the religion still maintained. The peculiar doctrinal expressions of the religious feelings, the expressions that we call Christian theology, are not part of the essence of Christianity. and the doctrines can therefore be changed when necessary or desirable. Doctrines are a matter of the head, but religion is a matter of the heart. With Schleiermacher, the antithesis between the head and the heart, which pervades virtually all theology today, conservative as well as liberal, became the fundamental basis for religion. Schleiermacher thoroughly understood the revolutionary nature of the changes he was proposing, for he referred to himself as the midwife of a new Christianity. Kant, as you recall, had made the same claim, but he said it in French, of course. The influence of Schleiermacher and Romanticism spread quickly throughout Europe and the United States. In mid-century, Charles Finney, the heretical Presbyterian revivalist, attacked the seminaries because they attempted to give young men intellectual strength to the almost entire neglect of cultivating their moral feelings. The student's intellect improves and his heart lies waste. In May 1850, Edwards Park, a professor at Andover Seminary, gave a speech to the Congregational Ministers of Massachusetts assembled in Boston. Entitled "The Theology of the Intellect and That of the Feelings," Park's speech suggested there were two sorts of theology and two sorts of truth. Ominously enough, Park began his speech by illustrating his point. A father tells the literal truth about astronomy to his children, but they learn nothing from him but falsehood. But, he said, I have also heard of a mother who, with a woman's tact, so exhibited the general features of astronomical science that although her statements were technically erroneous, her children still learned more truth than those of the father who spoke the literal truth. The theology of the heart, Park wrote, need not always accommodate itself to scientific changes, but may often use its old statements even if, when literally understood, they be incorrect. Charles Hodge of Princeton Seminary answered Park in a series of three articles in which he maintained that there was only one theology, not two. And Park's construction, which Hodge maintained was similar to Schleiermacher's, undermined the infallibility and the authority of Scripture. While Hodge attacked the faculty psychology presupposed by Park's theory of two theologies which might contradict each other, he did not exegete the teachings of the Bible on the nature of man. The antithesis between the head and the heart, on which both Schleiermacher and Park relied so heavily, is not derived from the Bible. Unfortunately, some of the most conservative Christian theologians have spoken carelessly, as though the heart, meaning the emotions, were more important than the head. This error was reinforced by the Romantic movement, which believed that life is deeper than logic, and by the materialists, who taught that religious emotions are facts, but religious doctrines are fairy tales. Today, the antithesis between the head and the heart and the obvious superiority of the heart is accepted in all churches. But the Bible makes no such disjunction. For as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. Why do you think evil in your hearts? Every intent of the thought of his heart was only evil continually. He was grieved in his heart. The imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. There are more than 750 occurrences of the word heart in the Old Testament alone. Many of those verses would be utter nonsense if the word were translated emotion. It is obvious to anyone who cares to study the Scriptures, rather than psychology, that a person thinks with the heart. He wills with the heart, he remembers with the heart, he imagines with the heart, he plans with the heart, he suffers emotions with the heart. The heart is simply the scriptural name for the unitary self, the person, the inward man, who does all these things. And it is thinking that makes all these things possible. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. The unbiblical antithesis between the heart and the head shaped popular religion in the 19th century and still shapes it today. The masculine component, the head, was subordinated to the feminine component, the heart. Revivalism was based upon this subordination, for the premise of revivalism is that it is not enough to believe with one's head. One must also trust with one's heart. When I was a teenager, the minister of the church I attended was fond of saying that some people would miss heaven by 12 inches, the distance between the head and the heart, for they believed with their heads, but not with their hearts. Sometimes this is stated in a slightly different form. In order to be saved, one must trust a person, not believe a creed. The biblical contrast is not between the head and the heart, but between the heart and the lips, between what one thinks or believes and what one professes. Isaiah 29:13 says, "These people draw near to me with their mouths and honor me with their lips, but have removed their hearts far from me." Within the church and society at large, the disjunction between the head and the heart was applied to men and women. Men were cold, rational, logical, intellectual. Women were loving, emotional, trusting, feeling, compassionate. This natural superiority of women made them the natural repositories of virtue and religion. Some religionists in the 19th century were quite willing to carry this false disjunction and misunderstanding of Christianity right into their doctrine of God itself. A.B. Simpson, the founder of the first Bible Institute in North America in 1883, the Missionary Training College for Home and Foreign Missions, and co-founder of the Christian and Missionary Alliance Church, wrote an article entitled Our Mother God, and I quote from the article, "The heart of Christ is not only the heart of a man, but has in it also the tenderness and gentleness of a woman. Jesus was not a man in the rigid sense of manhood as distinct from womanhood. But as the Son of Man, the complete head of humanity, he combined in himself the nature of both man and woman. In the Old Testament, we find God revealing himself under the sweet figure of motherhood. And this aspect of his blessed character finds its perfect manifestation in the Holy Ghost, our Mother God." Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science, held similar views. And Christian scientists today pray to our Father, Mother God. Eddy wrote, "We have not as much authority in divine science for considering God masculine as we have for considering him feminine, for love imparts the highest idea of deity." Another female-founded cult in the 19th century, the Shakers, believed in one God, not three male beings in one, but father and mother. A century earlier, a Scotch Presbyterian named James Fordyce had published his Sermons to Young Women, in which he opined that, quote, "the spirit of devotion depends on sentiment rather than thinking, on the feelings of gratitude and wonder, joy and sorrow, triumph and contribution, hope and fear, rather than on theological disquisition, however profound. Woman," he felt, "had been placed by Providence in circumstances peculiarly advantageous for the exercises of devotion." And the famous Dr. Benjamin Rush declared that the female breast is the natural soil of Christianity. This view, so alien to the Bible, implied that a religion so natural to women was somehow unnatural to men. It encouraged women to be aggressive in religious exercises and activities, and men to relegate religion to their mothers, wives, sisters, and daughters. But the natures of God and man were not the only doctrines affected by the feminization of theology. Once begun, the process of feminization occurred rapidly in many different doctrines. The revivalism of the 19th century, particularly the work of Charles Finney, transformed theology from Calvinism into Arminianism, from the sovereignty of God to the free will of man. A God who plans and acts is just too masculine to endure. The doctrine of the atonement in the hands of a man like Horace Bushnell became a way for God to affect the feelings of men, not a satisfaction of the justice of an angry God. God was a God of love, not truth, justice, or holiness. His primary characteristic became mercy, not sovereignty or justice. He had no wrath to be assuaged. The importance of doctrine gave way to the centrality of experience. This can be observed in the hymns written during the 19th century, as well as in the theology. Unlike the 18th century hymns of Isaac Watts, the 19th century hymns of Fanny Crosby, Frances Havergal, Philip Bliss, and others, including an increasing number of women, emphasized the feelings and emotions of the singers rather than the majesty of God. The Unitarians were particularly prolific, publishing 15 separate hymn books between 1830 and 1865. Austin Phelps of Andover Seminary, the seminary at which Edwards Park taught, co-authored with Park and Ferber the most important book on hymnology in America during the 19th century. Carrying out Park's theory of two theologies, those of the intellect and those of the feelings, Phelps explained that hymns express the heart of the church. They are to act as a kind of tonic to the worshiper. What ought to be avoided in hymns, according to Phelps, was an excess of the analytic element. Unpleasant subjects such as death, punishment, and hell ought to be minimized. The feminization of theology in the 19th century substituted a new Christ for the historical Christ. Since religion consisted in feelings, not knowledge, the historical Jesus disappeared and the Jesus in one's heart became the new Savior. The written word was eclipsed by the alleged promptings of the Holy Spirit. And the 20th century charismatic movement is simply a logical development of the ideas sent forth by Schleiermacher almost two centuries ago. Religious and philosophical ideas, Arminianism, revivalism, modernism, Kantianism, all incorporating a virulent anti-intellectualism, worked together to shape the church effeminate of the 19th and 20th centuries. By the mid-19th century, the two largest churches in the United States were the Roman Catholic and the Methodist. The Calvinists had been defeated. The old virile religion, whose passing Henry James lamented, has declined even further in this present decadent century. The professed descendants of Hodge and Warfield sound more and more like the moderates of the last century. Nevertheless, we may be confident that the preaching of God's truth will have the precise effect that he intends, whether it be destruction or edification. If God wills, the apostasy of the present age will be judged, and his truth once again understood and believed, and the church effeminate will become the church militant.